Hey, Ms. Linda, Ramona. See, just before you do, so it doesn't count against your time, I know you made a motion to postpone it until video conferencing was available, and as you know, that was denied. Hopefully, when this concludes, you'll feel that you had a chance to communicate your concerns, that we had a chance to express our concerns, and that both of you had a chance to address the questions that we had. I really feel pretty confident that this format will not in any way interfere with your ability or Mr. Sinatic's ability to communicate with us, nor for us to communicate with the two of you.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You want to go ahead then?
Sure. May it please the court, my name is Lisa Freeland, and I'm here on behalf of Ronald Williams. Your Honors, while Mr. Williams' Sixth Amendment right to trial by an impartial jury was violated, and a writ of habeas corpus can and should be granted under the more stringent subjective honesty test, I'd like to start today by addressing the questions in the court's May 11th letter.
Okay.
I hear some beeps. Should I wait?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that means.
Those are likely law clerks dialing in.
Yeah. Okay. Please go ahead.
Okay. This case has always involved actual bias on the part of the jurors because the facts that were developed, the path to relief even under the subjective honesty test, necessarily involved an initial showing by Mr. Williams of actual racial bias. In order to demonstrate that the jurors lied on voir dire about racial bias, Mr. Williams first had to establish that the jurors were in fact biased. The Commonwealth's defense has always been that the jurors in this case were not actually biased. They were unenlightened or they parroted language heard because of how and where they were raised, but the use of the slurs and other evidence in this case, the Commonwealth argued, did not evince bias.
And it could have let me ask you,
mm-hmm.
The whole concept of subjective bias here, and I know we're kind of strapped into that because of the case law, but it seems incredibly out of place because the research is all over the place that one can be incredibly biased and not realize that the bias. They can think they're the fairest person in the world. In fact, I remember when I was a common peace court judge, I'll never forget it. Voir dire, individual voir dire, in the case of a black and white rape. And I had a juror look me straight in the eye and tell me she was not biased. And I believe she believed that. And the question that she was answering was whether or not a white woman could ever consent to have sex with a black male, and she said, of course not. And she was absolutely telling the truth as far as she was concerned. So the whole idea of objective bias seems just really off the wall, and it also seems to me, and I'll ask Mr. Sinatic, the Constitution does not guarantee subjective fairness. It guarantees fairness, period. And especially after Pena Rodriguez, it's very clear that in this area of racial bias, we're not talking about subjective belief in fairness, but the criminal justice system absolutely demands objective fairness, not a biased jury that thinks that they're being very fair. So I know that's beyond a softball to you, but I'm trying to bog down in subjective bias because I don't think that gets us anywhere.
Right. Well, I have a couple of answers to that question. And the first one, just as an aside, is that the Commonwealth and the district court could have tried to view and analyze this case as one of unconscious bias, even though it really doesn't fit given the evidence that there would be unconscious bias. But I accept Your Honor's kind of assessment of the evidence. The science on this is all over the place, but neither the Commonwealth nor the district court ever looked at this as possibly a situation involving unconscious bias. They simply did not believe.
You did not argue that, correct? You've always accepted the subjective bias framing, as far as I can tell from the papers.
Well, I never argued anything about unconscious bias because it wasn't raised. I did early on, the decision was made by the court that the subjective honesty test applied, and in my proposed findings and facts and conclusions of law, as well as in my brief to this court, in the district court, I said that I was not conceding that it was a subjective honesty test, but I believe that I could meet that more stringent standard.
Okay.
In my briefs to this court, I directly argued that if on this evidence, the subjective honesty test could allow this conviction to stand, that another test had to be applied.
All right. And, so you have affirmatively conceded it, but neither did you preserve it below, as I understand it. Can you tell me, it's Judge Bibas, when I read McDonough talks about an honest though mistaken belief not being enough to invalidate, and our presidents in Hodge and Richard say the same thing, how do those decisions leave any room for anything other than a subjective report of bias?
Well, I'm going to give you a couple answers also, Judge Bibas. I disagree that the issue of an objective test was not preserved below, but looking at the McDonough standard and the dichotomy that it sets up, that something is either an honest mistake or an intentionally incorrect answer, take that standard and apply it to this case. The district court found that there was not an intentionally incorrect answer, if you want to put it in the parlance of McDonough. But this case, the issue in this case also can't be fairly characterized as an honest mistake. And the cases that this court has addressed in the past substantially differ on their facts and the potential outcome of the application of a subjective honesty standard. And I would suggest that this court is not bound by those decisions involving, you know, substantially different factual matters to rule in this case that a juror could, in fact, be actually biased, but that nevertheless the Sixth Amendment wasn't violated.
Ms.
Because
Freeland,
the honest mistaken, I'm sorry.
When I look at your reply brief, your heading number one of what you, how you've briefed this argument is Ronald Williams proved several jurors lied. When I read lie means it's not an honest mistake. And that's how you briefed it. And I understand you have an invitation, Vicki, to talk more broadly, but all the briefing and all that the state has been put on notice to be briefing here has been about whether they were lying or not. And so maybe we can focus on the issue as you briefed it, which is, can you satisfy, if that's the burden, and let's set aside whether that's the burden, Judge McKee is raising a different possibility, but if we get fast preservation and that's the burden, can you satisfy a burden of showing they've lied?
Absolutely. The evidence that was presented, and I'll give you just one example from Juror Bowser, and you'll find it in the appendix at page 77. Juror Bowser himself thought the use of the word nigger was proof of being racist. That was his testimony, and there was also testimony that he, in fact, used that term. If you only look even that narrowly at the evidence in this case, it demonstrates that the jurors here, they understood what they were saying and the import of their comments when they used the racial slur. They knew that it was evidence of racial bias, and they offered a different response at the trial court.
Ms. Freeland,
the other problem in this.
May I ask, what do we do? We are a court of review, not first view. We have a district court that actually heard all of these witnesses testify. We have a district court to which these arguments were made. It heard them, it weighed them, it considered, and the district court at Appendix 21 found that their subjective belief was that they honestly answered the questions posed to them. Now, how are we, on clearly erroneous review, supposed to disregard the district court's much better opportunity to observe and evaluate the witnesses?
A couple of things, Your Honor. The finding that you just referenced was based on another finding that the jurors had testified that they honestly answered the questions on voir dire. And if you look at the record is void of evidence that the jurors actually said that. So the subsidiary finding that you referenced is actually the critical finding that they were being subjectively honest is built on a house of cards. It's built on a fatally flawed finding that when you look at the evidence in the record is not supported. Not one of these jurors said that they honestly answered the question that was posed to them when it was posed to them on voir dire. The other point that you make about the district court's ability to observe these jurors and take in all of the evidence, the district court has not said a word in support of its finding about the credibility of the jurors. The word credibility is never used. It doesn't reference the jurors' demeanor, their inflection. It doesn't reference the totality of their testimony, including, in this case, their prior testimony at a prior hearing where they were found to have not been credible in testifying about their service as jurors in this case. And so the findings here, I understand how you would call them credibility findings, but there's nothing in the district court's opinion that indicates that he actually credited the jurors for the reasons that underpin the strong deference that's been afforded credibility determinations. And in this case, this is precisely the kind of case where this court can undertake a review and examination of the record and determine whether or not those findings are clearly erroneous. I agree that credibility determinations are accorded deference, but this court is not required to affirm even a credibility determination based on demeanor to the exclusion of the entire record. And that's what would happen in this case if this court on review were to find that those findings, that the district court's findings were not clearly erroneous. In the first instance, the predicate finding is not supported by evidence, which is the standard for finding it clearly erroneous. And that leaves the critical finding also wanting of evidence to support it. I do want to get back also to Judge McKee's questions about unconscious bias and the bias that was found here. There can be no doubt that in reaching its decision, the district court had to confront the question of whether the jurors were actually biased. It could not have found that they were honestly mistaken had it not also found or rejected that they were actually biased. And that's part of the reason why the honestly mistaken test doesn't fit here and why I've argued that if applying the subjective honesty test would allow the court to affirm a conviction when the jurors are actually biased but believed that they weren't, that's a standard that has to be set aside. And looking at Hodge and other cases of this court, there is nothing in those cases that stands in the way of this court saying this case is factually distinguishable, does not fit within this frame, and finding that the subjective honesty test does not apply.
Ms. Freeland, it's Judge Bibas again. I think you are right that our law deals with these issues. However, there's a difference between the Smith and the McDonald lines. I mean, the way I read Hodge and Richards, McDonough requires a subjectively incorrect answer, which is quite a high standard when people saying, oh, I wasn't hurt in an accident or I didn't know him in McDonough and Hodge and Richards is not enough. But there's the Smith line of cases, which is a separate line of cases that goes directly to the bias issue. You're suggesting that if we don't allow recovery under McDonough, there will never be defendant would prevail, but Smith would get at that issue more directly if it had been preserved. So maybe that's a segue to, I see that your client's earlier counsel argued this in the second PCRA petition in the state court, but I don't see anything else in the record that suggests that the Smith claim is properly before us. Am I mistaken? Is there a place you can point me to that preserved that issue? As a Smith claim, not as a McDonough claim.
Yeah, Your Honor, I don't think that I can point you to anything where the Smith claim as a distinct claim was preserved.
One minute.
I think my argument is that the issue of actual bias was before the district court. And if you have concerns about whether or not that case, that issue is properly before this court, a remand to the district court for the district court to consider the actual bias of these jurors under that legal under the Smith standard would be appropriate. And
last time we remanded it, it took about what, 8 years? I don't know why it took.
Well, yes, I mean, and I mean, I would obviously ask the court that if it were going to remand, either for further fact finding or for a consideration of the actual bias of these jurors under the Smith framework, that there be some time limit set on the time permitted for that. Because as you say, Judge McKee, it was actually 5 years that it took the district court from the final briefing to decision in this case in the first instance.
Time has expired.
I see that my time is up.
I'd like to ask one question,
oh, sure.
Please.
Go ahead.
Judge Cowan here. Does the affidavit, the Montgomery affidavit, satisfy the exceptional circumstances required to trigger, you know, the residual exception to the hearsay rule?
Yes, Your Honor. As I presented both in the district court and in my reply brief, I think that each of the factors that this court has identified for assessing the admissibility under the residual exception are met in this case. I can take you through them one at a time if you would like. I think that the most outstanding factors with respect to the trustworthiness of the statement are the credibility of Ms. Montgomery. Actually, she was credited by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court over the statements of the jurors in this case in vacating Mr. Williams' death sentence, but also the fact that the Commonwealth has had the opportunity to speak with and or examine Ms. Montgomery, and the only reason you know that didn't happen was because the testimony was then barred under Rule 606B.
Well, what is your response to the Commonwealth's argument that the affidavit should not have been accepted under hearsay habeas rule 7, because the Commonwealth questioned both the admissibility as well as the veracity, I guess, of Montgomery's allegations?
Well, the district court did not admit the affidavit because it found that the statements in it were uttered during deliberations, and that it also did not meet the standard under Pena-Rodriguez. So it never reached the question of whether it was admissible under the hearsay rule. I have suggested that affidavits can be admitted into evidence and have been by this court in the past in granting habeas relief, but the district court itself did not find that the statements were either admissible or inadmissible under the hearsay exception.
Ms. Freeland,
your brief asserts in any event that even without considering the Montgomery affidavit, we should rule in your favor. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Ms. Freeland, Judge Beavis, is there any reason the affidavit would not be Teague barred? Pena-Rodriguez was decided long after this conviction became final on direct review.
Well, and Your Honor, I don't think that the retroactivity doctrine is relevant to the admissibility of the evidence. The question is whether at the time of the evidentiary hearing, which was in 2012, and when the case was decided after briefing on Pena-Rodriguez, whether or not federal rule of evidence 606B would allow it under the standard the Supreme Court announced. And so the prior issue is whether the state rule 606B barred the testimony back in 1988 it may have been, or 89. But the question in this case is whether at the time of the evidentiary hearing and the time of the district court's decision, whether the rules of evidence as interpreted under Pena-Rodriguez would allow admission of that statement.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question sufficiently?
Yeah, I understand what you're getting at.
Okay.
Did you reserve time? I can't recall now.
I meant to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, but I admit that I did not do it at the beginning of my argument.
Okay. Thank you then very much for your argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Simatic?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Deputy Attorney General Greg Simatic here on behalf of the respondent appellees. I would submit to the court that this matter has been framed throughout the litigation as a McDonough claim, and I think that implicit in that is the assertion that the credibility of the jurors is to be viewed under the subjective analysis, and I would submit in light of the facts and circumstances of this case, there's no other form of analysis that would be workable or tenable in that you are trying to decipher the internal thought process and mental attitudes, for lack of a better term, of jurors here now 30-some-odd years after the fact. I think that
I know you make that argument in your brief, and we also oftentimes hear that, you know, the court can't go back and read mind, read the tea leaves. Every criminal case requires the jury to do exactly that. You're required basically to turn the intent of the person on trial. So I'm not that influenced by an argument that we now can't go back and fathom what the jurors were thinking. Let me ask this. The thing that disturbs me here, even let's assume that we're only dealing with subjective honesty. It would be one thing if a juror got up and all the way through said, yeah, I can be fair, I can be fair, I can be fair, I hate those people. That doesn't mean I can't be sure to them. And by the way, I don't think, given look around you, look at the demographic evidence, I see nothing wrong with viewing them differently than I view white people. That's one thing. But when you have a situation where a person has a record of using racial slurs and then denies that, that would seem to suggest, and there's expert testimony here to substantiate that, that in fact the person was subjectively lying when they suggested that or said that they really did not harbor bias. They had to be aware they were harboring bias, so they would have not changed their answers in terms of how they refer to black folks.
Well, Your Honor, since you mentioned expert testimony, I would submit that it is rather less clear-cut than that, in that Mr. Williams' own expert was unable to opine whether or not these specific jurors were or were not being subjectively dishonest. And likewise, he also conceded that a denial of prejudice could also be consistent with a lack of prejudice rather than concealment of prejudice that actually existed.
They did conceal it. That's my question. Here they did conceal it because they said one witness denied making the statement, said later on it was established that he was making. The testimony of one witness, and I think it may be the same juror, only referred to a coworker as nigger when the coworker was not around. That seems to suggest to me that the juror knows that, my goodness, there's something wrong here. I'm treating that person differently, which would call into mind subjective honesty when they said, no, I can be fair. That wasn't exactly the second question was asked, not the first question was asked.
I think, Your Honor, that sort of gets to the crux of the case, whether or not this court is prepared to declare that the use of the slur is in and of itself indicative of subjective dishonesty, given the questions that were asked at voir dire. And again, I would note that both the trial court, Mr. Williams' defense attorney, the defense attorney for his, I believe it was his stepbrother and co-defendant, and basically all the participants at the first trial had the opportunity to analyze the credibility of these jurors as they gave their responses during voir dire, as did the district court.
How long have you been a trial attorney, I assume? I don't know how many cases you've tried to been a part of, but I know what the law says. You and I both know the value of demeanor testimony and demeanor evidence. I know that's not any of the here nor there, given the state of the law. But saying that you can assess the credibility of a witness when they say, no, I can be fair, I find that less than persuasive, because to me, a trial judge, when someone says they can't be fair, the first thing that goes to the judge's mind is this person's trying to get out of jury duty. There's this little kabuki dance that takes place where the other side comes back, you get the person to say, oh, yeah, I can be fair. The other side gets up and goes, no, I can't be fair. It's just not a really persuasive argument to me. Now, maybe it's different from my colleagues.
Well, I certainly recognize that, Your Honor, but at the same time, none of the courts that have ever looked at these issues have ever proposed a workable alternative. In fact, voir dire is kind of viewed as sort of the first line of defense to prevent situations like this from occurring. So at least the process is given some value by the Supreme Court and, you know, all the courts on down that, you know, they seem to acknowledge there's some value to this process.
I'm not going to go against that centuries of law. I'm not suggesting there's no value to it. I'm suggesting on this record, one has to be at least concerned with the veracity of the answers that these jurors gave. Someone should ask a question.
Certainly. And, you know, Your Honor, I'm going to frankly admit that this record is troublesome. There's certainly some problematic language, and there are some real issues here. But that being said, at the same time, We run the risk of running afoul of the very same considerations that underlie the no impeachment rule.
Mr. Hinton-Symantec, it's Judge Bibas. Could you help us, if we need to draw some lines here, would this case have been different if Geisler, Bauer, Hanschick, Camphouse, these four jurors that the hearing was focusing on, if they had, let's say Geisler, Bauer, and Hanschick, let's say they had said, they've been asked voir dire, do you ever use the N-word? And they say, no, I never use the N-word. And then this comes down. Would a defendant have relief in that case?
It would be a very much of a different analysis, and I think his case would be much stronger. Because again, that's what I tried to emphasize in my brief, was looking at precisely the question that they were asked. And had they been asked that question and had they been dishonest, certainly it's a different calculus. So, you know, I'm more than willing to concede that to the court's question. But
you're talking about asking that during voir dire or after the trial?
I'm talking about in terms of voir dire.
No, I don't know. Any trial judge would let that question be asked during voir dire, unless there was some reason for it beforehand. I cannot imagine a trial judge allowing attorney to ask that question in voir dire. I can't fathom it. And I tried cases for 10 years, four of them were
sure.
homicides. And I
certainly
can't imagine it. And the question, the example that I gave, the DA went crazy, assistant DA went crazy when I agreed to ask the question on voir dire about whether or not the jurors believe that a white woman could ever consent to having sex with a black man. The DA was apoplectic of that. And he was a really good DA whom I have a lot of respect for. After the answers came out and it was developed, he became the leader in the courtroom in terms of trying to ferret this stuff out. But no judge is going to let that question be asked on voir dire that I know of. I can't imagine.
Well, I think practically speaking, I agree with you, Your Honor. I was just speaking purely hypothetically in terms of if it had been asked. You know, I grant the practicalities that it probably would not have been asked, nor I don't know that counsel would have necessarily wanted to be asked, either defense counsel or the Commonwealth at that point. But you know, that certainly would have put the case in a different light had that question been asked and had that question not been answered honestly. And I think
Did you agree that that's an impossibility, basically? It's so impossible to never occur.
Counsel, don't you agree that the claims of racial bias are especially suited for more objective inquiry? After all, didn't Dino Rodriguez single out racial bias as different than other more mundane forms of juror misconduct?
Yes, it certainly did. However,
and even if our review is deferential, don't you agree there is clear error if we left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made?
Well, I think, Your Honor, although Pena Rodriguez certainly did acknowledge and pay special attention to the pernicious influence of racial discrimination in the criminal justice system, it did not give carte blanche for relief or carte blanche even for inquiry in light of Rule 606B. And simply put, again, under the very specific facts and circumstances of this case, we just don't believe that Mr. Williams has made out what he needs to make out in order to establish he's been entitled to relief.
Well, given the jurors' own admissions that they have used racial slurs in the past, as well as the testimony offered by the two trial witnesses, and one of the jurors showing that racial comments were made in connection with the trial itself, why shouldn't we conclude that the district court made a mistake here?
Well, I think going under the analysis in Pena-Rodriguez, mere offhanded remarks absent a showing that such attitudes played a definitive role, or maybe not definitive is the right word, but a strong role in the outcome of the proceeding, the Supreme Court still expressed qualms about being able to entertain that type of testimony, that type of evidence.
Do you think Justice Kennedy would have read this record and referred to these remarks as mere offhanded remarks?
Well, given that so many of them occurred in times, places, and circumstances far removed from the trial, I think that's sort of an open question.
Evidence here that it was said by jurors at the juror room. There is a question as to identifying the juror that said the specific words, but the conduct of the jurors that testified as to what occurred in the jury room. It's not breathtaking.
Again, it's very troubling. But that being said, under the applicable...
What if the difference seem very troubling and breathtaking, other than the fact that if you say it's breathtaking, it undermines your argument? What's the difference?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear that.
No, the question was, isn't this breathtaking? You said it's very troubling, and I asked, other than the fact it would undermine your argument, what is the difference between breathtaking and very troubling?
Practically speaking, I don't know that there's a tremendous amount of difference between those two terms.
Counselor, Pena-Rodriguez involved the use of the statements at the trial in regard to the defendant's conduct. The way I read Appendix 133 is none of the nine living jurors heard racial slurs being used during the trial or in relation, that we're talking here about some testimony about statements that they made before or after the trial. And so is that different?
I think that it is, Your Honor. And thank you for pointing that out. Again, and that's one of the points we've been trying to make throughout these proceedings, that you run the risk when you're looking at conduct or statements that are so far removed from the trial or from the actual context, it really opens up an unlimited area of inquiry and all the concerns about juror harassment.
Some of the statements were made during the trial and during deliberation, I thought, some of them. Am I wrong about that? Some Negro lover, wasn't that? Or I hope your daughter marries one, wasn't that during the trial?
That's the Montgomery affidavit whose admissibility is questioned. I thought we were focused. Maybe we're switching back and forth between the two issues, but we had been
correct.
Talking about what these jurors were testifying to. The Montgomery affidavit is the separate Pena-Rodriguez 606B issue.
That is correct, Your Honor. And again, the Montgomery affidavit was very light on detail in terms of time, place, speaker, anything like that. And one of the issues that we ran into was never really having had an opportunity to test the veracity of Ms. Montgomery or her account or her statements. And so she's obviously deceased, and that is why we felt it would not be proper to admit her affidavit at this point, because it has not been subject to proper testing for an issue of this magnitude.
2 minutes.
Well, don't you agree that calling someone a dumb nigger in the workplace or a juror stating that it's in a courthouse a hallway, a damn nigger always causing trouble, goes far beyond mere banter, and it implicates more than just a denial of a perfect trial if someone has that type of thoughts in their mind?
It is, again, very troubling. But at the same time, I don't know that it's possible to articulate a workable standard that would not sort of basically do violence to the system in terms of trying to perfect it. Because it is, again, a question of drawing the line in that, are we prepared to find that any time a juror has ever uttered a racial slur, that they're precluded from jury service, and that if a defendant can point to a comment of that nature from a juror, that they're entitled to a new trial?
That would be a horrible rule, wouldn't it? To say that any time a person has uttered a racial slur, they would be precluded from jury service in a trial involving the group that was the subject of that racial slur, that would be a horrible rule. Someone said, and I think it was Brennan said in the dissent, that would really be too much justice. We can't have that, can we? Precluding jurors who have other racial slurs from being on juries involving that racial group, we can't tolerate that, can we?
No, I think that would certainly be extremely unworkable. And
very unworkable. Oh, goodness.
But at the same time, when you look at the actual conduct statements that Mr. Williams is pointing to, I don't know how you would draw a line short of that.
So you're saying that we can't have a rule where jurors who have bandied about the term nigger are not allowed to sit on juries where black folks are on trial. That I agree that we can't have such a situation. Couldn't imagine such a situation. Terrible troubles to able players.
Time has expired.
Anything okay, if there are no... excuse me, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
No, I didn't know if you wanted to respond at all to the question. My assessment of that would be just a terrible state of affairs if we allowed such a situation to prevail.
Very much so, Your Honor. And
very much so, yes.
Again, trying to come up with a workable solution here, I think, is where sort of the issue lies. And I think that both the Pena-Rodriguez court and the other courts that have looked at this have sort of recognized that as an issue. And simply put, I just don't know that Mr. Williams has made out what he needs to show under the applicable law.
Okay, thank you. Anybody want a transcript of the argument?
Yes, please.
Okay, could we get a transcript? And I'll ask the appellee to pay for that, given the fact that Mr. Williams is represented by a public defender. And if you can check with Mr. Kane, he'll, if you're not aware of it already, he'll go over the logistics of how you get the transcript.
Okay.
Okay, we thank counsel for the argument. We'll take the matter under advisement.